Civic Flame, an educational podcast where we tackle the U.S. Constitution section by section and explore how it is, and is not, shaping the U.S. government today. It's been a long few weeks for many of us here in the U.S., and I've had people ask me, more than I like, whether or not the Constitution matters because it's doing nothing, according to them. To that I say, the Constitution is a piece of paper. What did you expect it to do? The Constitution lives nowhere if it does not live in our hearts, and more importantly, in our actions. We have to be willing to hold our leaders accountable to the Constitution, whether we like the leaders or not, whether we agree with them or not. Otherwise, it doesn't work. Does that mean the U.S. Constitution's at fault and we should get rid of it? No, of course not. It means we should recommit to the work of civic responsibility and get back to doing what democracy requires. Why am I talking about this? Because today is Article 6 of the Constitution, the article that makes the Constitution the supreme law of the land. Today, we're going to talk about how that works, why that works, and why I, personally, am not ready to give up on the United States Constitution. Let's go. I do solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that I take this obligation freely, without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, and that I will well and faithfully discharge the duties of this office on which I am about to enter. So help me God. That's basically the oath I took when I worked with the U.S. Naval Academy. As a teacher, I didn't have one of those cool rappel-off-the-building kind of jobs. It's a similar oath I took when I became a notary public in Massachusetts. Also, no cool rappelling-off-the-building kind of jobs. And it's an oath anyone who works for the government takes. Why? Because in our scheme of law, the Constitution reigns supreme. And it is important to note that this oath derives similarly from the oath in the Constitution in Article 2 that covers the President of the United States. Because the founders knew that sometimes the call is coming from inside the House, and that in many ways, the hardest enemy or adversary to see is the one right in front of your face. But we promise to obey the Constitution, which will, hopefully, keep our eyes fixed on the prize, democracy, and not get lost in the politics. Article 6 starts with all debts contracted and engagements entered into before the adoption of the Constitution shall be as valid against the United States under this Constitution as under the Confederation. This is just that basic sense of, yes, support the Constitution, but we promise it won't make you broke. There was a lot of instability on the way to the early Republic, insurrections and other problems that related to an inability to pay the government's debts, including suppliers, fighters, widows and orphans from the Revolution. Next comes the big part. The Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made, or which shall be made, under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary, notwithstanding. There are a few things going on here. Note that the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. This is what we call the Supremacy Clause. Any treaties made under the Constitution's authority are at the head of the hierarchy of U.S. law. Now, this means federal law most of the time. Remember from our discussion on how judges make decisions with Dr. Chris Bailey, the Supreme Court has the power of judicial review. That means it can interpret the law and strike down any laws that a majority of the judges, 5 out of 9 now, but we've had as few judges as 5 in total, feels is compatible to the Constitution. State laws tend to be easier to strike down because a lot of that comes down to who has the power to do what. States have a lot of power in their own spheres, but if they make laws that conflict with the federal Constitution, then those laws are not valid. We saw a lot of these cases come up during the wake of Brown v. Board of Education, the 1954 unanimous Supreme Court decision that made illegal, de jure, that's by law, segregation in K-12 public schools. Multiple cases came up, and occasionally still pop up, over this. Now, there's a whole long history of court cases and current political issues that still arise out of the South's rage at being forced to work, learn, and play side by side with Black folks. But that's for another time. Today, we're looking at the case Cooper v. Aaron. This was in 1958 in Little Rock, Arkansas, where the governor forbade the desegregation of public schools. If you want to see a real profile in courage, check out the stories of the Little Rock Nine and people like Ruby Bridge, who, in 1960, at the ripe old age of 6, endured incredible, daily, repeated harassment and hatred when she became the first person to integrate schools in Louisiana. Given the way Louisiana still treats New Orleans, I feel like there's some folks who've really never gotten over that fact. But during this time, case after case was coming before the court, and the courts kept saying, federal law requires equal protection under the law. The 14th Amendment requires it, and it requires due process, and it gives Congress the ability to make laws pursuant to that end. As much power as the states have over education, to set the curriculum, to decide on standardized tests, pick the number of days in the school year, and so much more, those decisions cannot violate federal law. Students have a right to K-12 education. The state must provide that right in a way that is compatible with the U.S. Constitution. Now, there's an amount of ability to move here, right? Some states can have more free sports for everybody. Other states can have students who have to pay for sports, and so on. It doesn't have to be exactly equal, but there is a floor of equal protection that states cannot fall below. And we'll talk a little bit more about this, well, we'll talk a lot more about this when we get to the 14th Amendment. But in Cooper, the court said a few important things to try and close this issue, which it didn't, but still, they were trying to be like, hey, we really do mean that desegregation thing, please get your people in order. And so the court said, the constitutional rights of children not to be discriminated against in school admission on the grounds of race or color declared by this court in Brown can neither be nullified openly and directly by state legislatures or state executives or judicial officers, nor nullified indirectly by them through evasive schemes for segregation, whether attempted ingeniously or ingenuously. Now, a lot of this comes from the fact that you'll notice they mention state legislators, executives, and judicial officers. This is the entire government system of these states were trying to nullify, that is, ignore or make void what Brown v. Board had said. The evasive schemes, and I don't know if you can hear my cat Cassiopeia or Cassian, depending on who in the house is talking about her, but she's meowing at us right now. She doesn't like segregation either. But when we talk about this, the evasive schemes are what are called segregation academies. One of the reasons school vouchers are still so contentious today is that a lot of their origin comes from giving white students vouchers from public money to go to private schools while underfunding schools where majority Black students went. And that was supposed to be the way that we got over segregation in education, because as it turns out, there is some level of segregation that you're allowed within the private sphere. For all of the good that our desegregation and anti-segregation laws have done, they've never really held up well in the private sphere. The United States has always carved out special rules for people who have a lot of money. And in this case, if you can buy your way into a private club or a private school, there's a lot of discrimination that can be allowed in what those schools or places do. And so this becomes a big question of how and where does the court have jurisdiction over what people get to do? That will go back and forth over time. But in Cooper, the court continues to really try and clarify what the 14th Amendment requires, at the very least in public accommodations and around public goods. And so it says, the interpretation of the 14th Amendment enunciated by this court in the Brown case is the supreme law of the land, and Article 6 of the Constitution makes it of binding effect on the states, anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding. No state legislator or executive or judicial officer can wage war against the Constitution without violating his solemn oath to support it. This came up quite a lot after the 2015 Obergefell v. Hodges decision as well, where you had sort of sentient cave trolls like Kim Davis saying that her religious beliefs meant she didn't have to issue marriage licenses to gay people. But when the federal government says marriage between two people of the same gender or sex is the law, then it's the law. And if your religion says you can't obey the law in that job, then you shouldn't have that job. And that became the argument of the supreme law of the land is the Constitution. You've taken an oath to uphold the Constitution. The Constitution says this is your job. If you can't do it, go get another job. So right here, we get that continued explanation that when a law conflicts with the Constitution, it is invalid. Even if it is a state law, it still can't conflict with the Constitution. I mention this because it's a bit easier to understand at the state level when these questions come up. In federal cases, you see a lot of them that are battles between agencies, conflicts between federal law, and other very clear and often politicized and wrapped up in different kinds of questions and fights. But that supremacy clause, again, that's what we call the supreme law of the land thing, is supposed to be clear. But like every other aspect of the Constitution, it's not self-enforcing. The final section of Article 6 is a bit about religious freedom and the ways in which we cannot require any religious beliefs or any religious tests for any specific offices. It says, "The senators and representatives before mentioned and the members of the several state legislators and all executive and judicial officers, both of the United States and of the several states, shall be bound by oath or affirmation to support this Constitution, but no religious tests shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the Constitution." This is where the cool podcast, Bound by Oath, gets its name. If you want to really get into the nitty-gritty of court cases and hear from people who work in the legal field, as opposed to the academic side like me, this is a solid and reasonably accessible listen, and I recommend it. But what this clause also shows us is there is no religious requirement for anyone in public office that is allowed under the Constitution. And if you think about Mamdani, the mayor of New York, there was so much anger that he didn't take his affirmation of office on the Bible. But that's not required. That is a common thing that people have done over time. And it's one that I disagree with. I believe that that elevates the Bible in this case to idolatry and a political image rather than a spiritual one. But that's a personal belief. The legal understanding is, even if it's something that you want to do, if it's something your religion allows, it's still not acceptable to demand it or to require it. It is an extra, not a something you have to do, because we have a government that is meant to understand the ways in which religion has been corrupted by the political sphere and used in many ways to take away the rights of the people through it. And so the Constitution is clear on that here, and we'll talk a lot more about that as we go several days, I'm not even sure still how many days, when we get to the First Amendment in the Bill of Rights. But it also makes clear that if you want to be an officer of the government in any capacity, that you do take an oath, not necessarily to a deity, but for sure to the United States Constitution above all else. This is what makes our system special, or at least at the very beginning, it was one of the things that made our system special. Other people around the world do it now. In 1787, it was not very common. And it was what John Adams wrote before he was the second president, while he was serving as a lawyer from Massachusetts. "We want a government of laws and not of men." That is in the Massachusetts Constitution, which, for what it's worth, is older than the United States Constitution. I'm bound by law to mention whenever Massachusetts has a win in these conversations, otherwise the ghost of the Dropkick Murphys shows up and starts playing bagpipes at my house at 2:47 in the morning. That's just a Massachusetts thing. But at the end of the day, it is important to understand the government of laws and not of men is vital to the security of democracy. Because while democracy is representing the will of the people, the idea is because it's representing the will of the people in power will change over time. The only way to guarantee consistent legal justice under the law is to make sure that it is always the laws and not the people who are going to have the last word on what's going on. So anybody who is interpreting the law maliciously or wrongly, accidentally, or for their own benefit is not going to be successful, that it is the laws themselves upon which we make our challenges and to which we make our appeals. Well, that's all for this week and all of the substantive parts of the U.S. Constitution. Well done for making it through with me. We'll do a short talk next week about Article 7, which is the ratification section, and a little bit of an intro to the Bill of Rights. Until then, keep on listening, liking, and following. I saw that we made it to 300 listens, and I'm so excited about that. Thank you to everybody who's been supporting me so far. I'm printing up stickers that I'm thinking about sending to folks who engage with our content. As always, check us out on Blue Sky, Instagram, and Substack, and then if I ever get those stickers made, you'll know about it. Until then, keep the civic flame burning bright, and take care out there. The Civic Flame is a Dr. Fun Sponge Media production with creator Amber Veo and sound producer Matthew Munyon. Thanks for listening.